Welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. Headlines from this month urging upcountry Maui residents to conserve water could have been written a decade ago and in just about every year since. In past, farmers have been told that or have had to import feed for their animals, increasing costs for their upkeep and of the retail products the farms produce. Lucien Dene would know about that. She lives on a small farm. Hers is in East Maui. But of the water issues throughout Maui, she knows plenty. She's participated in the Maui County water planning process for almost two decades, and she's on the line with us now. Hi there.
Hello, Beth Ann.
Good to talk to you.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
Well, you know, we went back and looked at some of these headlines from not just this year, last year, several years ago.
Right. And go back a decade, it's like upcountry drought declarations. It's the 2003, 2006, 2011, 2012, 2013. It's a persistent situation.
Given the fact that it has persisted and for this long, have there been enough measures to be able to look at what that means, you know, even longer term, not just what happens this year in a couple years, but what if that begins to be the pervasive condition?
Well, this is what a lot of folks in the upcountry farming community are concerned with. I've met several times with a working group that represents, farmers island-wide, but many of them are upcountry, and they just feel like we should accept this as a persistent sort of condition and have a strategy to deal with it. And the strategy is not just drought declarations where everyone has to cut back on their water use. The strategy needs to be managing the water, because on the other hand, you didn't go into the flooding statistics. You look at our hazard mitigation plan, and it goes, you know, heavy flooding, you know, 1966, 1968, 1970, 1982, 1988, you know, we have heavy flooding every few years, too. And that's all water that needs, you know, is just being wasted, basically.
Right. That your point is that could be captured and used to mitigate what happens with the drought.
Stored. And we have not invested in storage like we should be. As a person who studied, you know, water over a longer term, I did a lot of research in the beginning of 2002, 2003 to write about where our policies had, water policies had come from and where they were going. And it became abundantly clear that every report that was done, for Maui County at least, really emphasized increasing storage. And yet we've had only one real major storage project in the last, like, 40 years, and that was to improve our upcountry reservoir capacity up in the Olinda area. And, you know, that was done in the, I think, the early 1990s, late 1980s. And then we've done nothing since. Thank goodness we did that, or we would really be in a bad shape. Now, that increased our capacity by, I think, around almost 100 million gallons of storage. So we really need to look at storage as part of the cycle, because when we have plenty of water, we have plenty of water. When we have no water, we need to rely on the storage. The no-water times are not usually long. That's another factor that really needs to be figured in.
Lucien, we've heard that sort of same frame refrain of, you know we should be doing this, or this would be really helpful, and then attention moves elsewhere. What do you think it will take to be able to focus it very clearly on a condition that now has become, at least in the minds of the farmers and others that you've talked to, the new normal?
Well, I know it's a priority among farmers and even, you know, upcountry water users. You know, even if you're not a farmer, everybody's affected. And it could be other parts of the island as well. You know, there have been some drought restrictions for central Maui from time to time. I really think that, I hate to say it, it starts at the top. We need some visionary leadership at the top levels who say, you know, yes, we may not use storage every day of the year, but by having it, we make it so that we are hedging our bets against the future. And if this is the new normal, some of the folks at UH, you know, Climate Center, are saying that our wind patterns are changing. Now, the rain follows the wind as well as the forest. And if our winds drop the water at lower elevations and not at the higher elevations, then we're just not going to have the forest cover that holds the water and lets it seep out into the aquifers. It's going to be very different. Also, rising sea levels, if salt water comes in further, even, you know, a few meters, 6 feet further in, underground it's coming in further, too, and some of our wells are not that far from the coast. So that means the area where the water is saltier, it's going more inland under the landmass. So there's many, many implications here, and I know the city and county of Honolulu is taking this very seriously, doing a lot of planning. They're reviving old reservoirs, considering if new ones are needed. I would just hope Maui would take a page out of the same book.
A hope is one thing, but any real action might be something else that would obviously be something you'd welcome. Is there a conversation?
I'd be willing to help organize on it because
the popular opinion is there. Well, I mean, I'm looking at this from the point of, you know, having all the aspirational conversation is one thing, but being able to take that into action and to see at least some steps happening on that. Is there anything besides the conversation about all this happening now?
Well, there is, like I say, this working group has been very successful at getting their ideas before the county council and moving many of them forward. Unfortunately, Councilmember Guzman, who was the ag head of the ag committee, has now been reassigned to another committee, and he was really a spearhead for, you know, he really was an open mind for this. So I hope our new upcountry representative, Ms. Sugimura, would be equally open, because the council could do a lot to influence this policy. They hold the purse strings. This is a favorable time for the county to get funding for long-range projects. There's revolving funds for water projects that are available through federal funds in the state. And this is really a matter of tapping into, I think, a variety of funding sources. So the leadership in this probably will come from the farm community. Of course, organizations like Sierra Club would be, you know, right there 100% saying, yes, we need this, we need to do this. The state has its own drought management plan, as a matter of fact. It's a few years old, maybe four or five, but it gives suggestions like locating private wells that could be activated for public use in time of drought emergency, or wells on state land that are not often used. And we have several private wells that are not used that are upcountry Maui. If we could make the investment, which would be, you know, of a relatively manageable nature, to hook them into a nearby tank and pump them only during drought emergencies. They're expensive to pump because they're high elevation, but they're good water and they're not being used. That could be a short-term solution just for the 4 or 5 days when there's just, you know, no water and people have to stop, you know,
using it, right?
Any water on their crops.
We're going to go in just a second, but, you know, there's always this kind of perennial nod to, could there ever be a desalination plant, or should we be looking into that? Obviously a very expensive proposition.
Yeah, the county's done a number of studies on that. It hasn't penciled out thus far, but, you know, with solar power coming in, that might change. But frankly, I think we have less expensive solutions at hand if we did a little engineering, you know, social engineering as well as engineering.
And a little political will to make it all happen.
And
a few bucks, too.
And a lot of political muscle to make it happen. Well, we're having a mayoral race in a year and a half, and it'll start, I'm sure, in 6 months. And that should really be something that we're all talking about. And if I have anything to say, it will be.
And one can imagine you will. Thank you very much, Lucienne. Good to talk to you, as always.
Yes.
Lucienne Dene is a freelance journalist, grant writer, and historical researcher. She lives on a small East Maui farm and is the conservation chair of the Sierra Club Maui. She frequently speaks on water resource issues and has participated in the Maui County water planning process for almost two decades. Coming up in the program, we'll look at the water shortage on Hawaii Island.
This week on This American Life, we replay one of the most popular stories that we've ever put on the air about a brother and sister who want to escape a fantastically overprotective mom. And to do that, they invent an entire family, the McCrearys, who they say they're babysitting for. Not that the mom didn't get suspicious.
She said, "I just got off the phone with Mrs. McCreary. She hasn't seen you in weeks."
That's this week.
Hear This American Life, Saturday at 1 p.m.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Get ready. Here comes your backyard quiz. Today we're considering the water shortages in upcountry Maui, as you just heard, and North Kona on the Big Island, that's coming up. But for today's backyard quiz, we're looking at how a community on a third Hawaiian island was able to overcome a geographic distribution of water that was less than ideal. The island of Molokai is unique in many ways, including the fact that the agriculture industry is a major driver of the island's economy. Farming is still a vital source of both economic and physical sustenance for Maui's, for Molokai's residents, unlike other islands where tourism and defense dwarf other industries. Of course, farming isn't possible without a reliable source of water, and that was a problem on Molokai. Much of the arable land is located on the dry leeward side of the island. To bring water there, a complex series of aqueducts transports water from rainy and mountainous northern Molokai to farms in the central and leeward parts of the island. Now for today's backyard quiz, can you name this Molokai water system? And as you're listening to the rebroadcast of The Conversation, we won't be taking any calls to answer the backyard quiz, but you can always call us at 11 a.m. when we're live.
Aloha, I'm taiko artist Kenny Endo. If you want to listen back to a show, visit the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org.
We talked about the protracted water shortage in upcountry Maui, and according to the state's drought map, moderate drought continues on much of Hawaii Island, too. It's not just the lack of rain. There are reports that residents are failing to self-regulate their water use, even though they've been asked to conserve. The Big Island Board of Water Supply issued a mandatory 25% reduction in January, with above-average temperatures and below-average precipitation forecast into fall. What to do about the lack of water is an ongoing problem. Heather Kimball is the chair of the Hawaii Island Group of the Sierra Club. She joins us now by phone. Hi, Heather.
Hi, Bethann. Thanks for having me on.
You know, we were just talking with Lucien Dene on Maui and just taking a look at the drought map of Hawaii and seeing how much drought there really is. We also get these periodic reports that it eased a little bit, but then it comes back again. What are you seeing now, particularly in North Kona?
Well, we are seeing some easing of the drought. We've had in just the last recent week a little bit more ambient rainfall in that area. And with the water restrictions in North Kohala, this isn't really about drought. It's actually a mechanical issue more so. The region has 13 wells, and four of those are not operational at the moment. And so the water restrictions are largely based on that mechanical issue.
The drought, though, isn't helping. And when you look at the map, when you take a look at the Hawaii drought, the map that the Department of Land and Natural Resources puts out under current conditions, they've got it looking like there's pretty much a moderate drought happening across the island.
Yes, yes. There's the bulk of the island is under moderate drought conditions. There is a section of Kohala that's under a higher drought restriction. They've got about a 10% irrigation restriction going on up there. It's just the area sort of south Kona that's actually seeing a little bit of rain right now, but we're still well under normal levels for the year.
And that seems to be what the forecast is for the rest of the summer and going into fall, as that seems to be a condition that, like Maui of Hawaii Island, will be dealing with too. And you say there are mechanical issues with these wells. What's happening to be able to further the not just the conversation but some actual action so that the water issue isn't one?
Well, I think this issue with the mechanical issues really highlights how tenuous our access to water is on the Big Island. And so the Department of Water Supply is trying to make some changes in how they operate in order to have some redundancy and make sure that the access to the county supply is continuous. They're also trying to do a little more outreach to folks. There was a fifth well that went down late in June, and that really put us into an emergency situation in North Kohala. And their response at that time was to actually go out and talk to high-volume users in person and express the urgency of them participating in the water restrictions.
We heard, though, that people were not terribly enthused about doing that.
Yeah, that has been an issue. So when the initial failures of the wells occurred in January, there was an initial drop-off in terms of residential usage. And then as we got to about April, that trend sort of tapered off. And I think there was, talking to folks around this area, there was a failure to communicate sufficiently to everyone that water restrictions were in place. And I think also folks became a little bit fatigued with the whole process of trying to conserve water, although I think it's fairly simple to take some easy steps to reduce your water usage. And then there's also the perception issue that hotels and the golf courses here are still green and still irrigating. And it's important to be clear that these folks are on private well systems, and they're reusing gray water, non-potable water. And so I think that the Department of Water Supply is really making a greater effort to communicate with folks about the urgency of reducing our water in real simple ways.
Sometimes, though, when an agency is trying to get a word out, it can be not as effective as when people actually are talking to each other in their own communities and in their own neighborhoods. The fact that, you know, people began to feel fatigue over all of this, or may see water use elsewhere and not understand why or how that water is being generated and or recycled, seems to be part of the deep understanding that I'm sure you'd like to see get through those neighborhoods and those communities. Are there efforts underway to talk to people in smaller groups and have them do sort of a friend-to-friend outreach?
I'm not aware of any efforts of that sort, but that certainly is a good idea. And one of the points that I want to make about water conservation is that it's actually a triple win. So when you conserve water, it also takes energy to bring water to your home or to treat wastewater, and it also costs money. So if you are making efforts to conserve water, you're protecting that resource, but you're also reducing your carbon footprint and you're reducing your costs. So regardless, it makes sense to work on reducing our water supply now, because we don't know what's going to happen in the future. The trends that are projected by climate change show the leeward sides becoming drier and warmer as time goes on. So it's good for us to put in place the kind of actions now and get used to those as part of our daily lives so that we can continue to maintain this valuable resource.
Very often families know that if kids come home and start to give the fisheye to what mom and dad and the rest of the family are doing, that you may see a little bit of change there. Any movement within the schools to be able to get some of these points out into the public?
I'm not sure, but that's an excellent idea, and you're absolutely right. That's one avenue to get people focused on this issue. Another tool that has worked in other areas is actually to compare your water usage rates with your neighbors in the bill, and that's been used effectively for energy usage reductions. Is to people get a little competitive when they see what their neighbors are doing, and they want to show that they're equally resourceful in conserving water.
So in the short term, then, as we've just been talking about some ideas that may come in, do you see that there is anything in particular that the county should be doing, or that you'd like to see other groups work in tandem to make possible, given the fact that it doesn't look like you're going to get a lot of rain?
Well, there's certainly working on getting those wells up and running again. The one of them will be up at the end of the month, but the water restrictions will continue to be in place as the other three come back online. But I think the peer-to-peer conversations that you were talking about are certainly something that need to happen. And we, as a group, the Sierra Club here on the Big Island, will certainly be reaching out to folks and encouraging them to just take simple actions to reduce their water usage. You know, don't wash your cars, run full loads of laundry, full loads in the dishwasher. If you're brushing your teeth or washing your dishes, you know, fill the sink up, fill a glass up, and use that rather than keeping the water running continuously. If you have irrigation systems in your yards that are set on timers or anything like that, once there is some rain, you know, check those timing systems. Maybe you don't need to irrigate as much. And really, we should only be irrigating if your livelihood is dependent on that. If you're remodeling or you're landscaping, look for appliances and toilets that have low water usage, and even consider xeriscaping your yard and selecting drought-tolerant plants in your yard.
That's a good list, and we'll see who takes you up on that. We'll see by looking at what happens with the water usage and hoping that those wells come online soon. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Heather Kimball is the chair of the Sierra Club Mokuloa Group on Hawaii Island. Professionally, she's an ecologist working on climate change mitigation and adaptation.
Will humans ever stop fighting wars once and for all?
If you go out and ask a bunch of random people that question, you're going to get...
No.
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 I just think that it's too ingrained in our human nature.
Yeah.
Is there such a thing as human nature, like that's forever and ever?
What can we do about it? Are we stuck or...
Or can we change who we are?
Yeah.
That's next time on Radiolab.
Saturday morning at 10.
This next story will not surprise you. Honolulu is full of potholes. Yes, we can see your eye roll from here. Fixing potholes is costing taxpayers and drivers millions. Civil Beat intern reporter Courtney Teague has today's reality check. Hi, Courtney.
Hi, Beth Ann. Thanks for having me on.
Well, you know, we heard last year that we have in Honolulu the 11th worst roads among large urban areas. Not good news, but not necessarily unexpected news. But to find out how much this is costing drivers and taxpayers, both to be able to repair the roads and just to repair your car when you go into some of those deep potholes, that's pretty astounding. How much is it costing us?
So Honolulu drivers actually pay about $745 annually because of car problems stemming from poor road conditions. That's about $200 more than the national average.
And in terms of how much it costs us to keep filling those potholes?
Well, we don't know that figure exactly, but between claims and lawsuits over the past 5 years, taxpayers have paid about $2.5 million.
A lot of money there too, but it seems that we are always seeing some road repair work being done. filling the potholes, but we've questioned for a long time, are we filling them with the right thing? Are we sort of being, you know, penny wise and pound foolish with them, with the asphalt and maybe even the time to get out there and fix them so that those cracks don't widen and water gets underneath it and the whole cycle starts all over again? What have you been told?
So part of what's at issue here is Honolulu's climate. That constant sun and rain is hard on the asphalt, but it's not necessarily harder on the asphalt than other parts of the country that see freezing temperatures or snow. But what really seems to be the crux of the issue here is the quality of repairs that the city is doing. They've been described as cost-effective but amateurish by one UH engineering expert.
I bet we so can way- name who that is. That would be... Professor Providoris, no.
Right, right. So the city fills potholes by clearing them out, filling them in with asphalt. However, he points to superior European techniques that involve squaring off the edges of the pothole, filling them in with asphalt, and then driving over them with a heavy truck or some sort of heavy machinery that really compacts it down.
Isn't this also a matter of setting time, too? Because very often we've seen potholes being fixed, and then off they go to work on the next one, and cars, you know, drive on it, and it may not have time to actually cure.
Yeah, sure. So there's just so many calls to get to. Actually, last year, between city roads and state highways and freeways, about 76,000 potholes were filled. So a lot of the time when potholes are just packed down with shovels or not with heavy machinery, those potholes are already being hit by traffic and sometimes even rain that can open them right up again. So that is a problem as well.
Which many of us know, having driven past them or tried to get around them. Thanks a lot, Courtney. Oh, what to do about this? That's the question we've been asking for a really long time, huh? Thanks very much. We'll keep asking it and see if we get any better answers. Courtney Teague is an intern at civilbeat.org. Every day we check in with Civil Beat for a reality check. Today we pick up a conversation we started several years ago with Dr. Willie Parker. He is a former Hawaii resident who left the comfort of his island obstetrics practice to offer services including abortion to women largely in poverty and of color in the Deep South. Since then, he's become known for his advocacy of women's reproductive rights, which he says is at the nexus of his Christian faith. He's on his way back to Honolulu to speak this week about his memoir, Life's Work, A Moral Argument for Choice. We talked before he left for the trip, and I asked him if his practice has changed and what he's observed in women's health care since the advent of the Trump administration.
Well, since I last talked to you in 2015, what we've seen is the advent of more laws that provide more restrictions at the local level. Roe has now been in place for 44 years, but there's no shortage of policies around to the tune of about 200 to 300 a year, where bills get signed into legislation, largely a function of the Tea Party movement that was ushered in as a reaction to the election of President Barack Obama. So with the advent of more restrictions, we're seeing women with more waiting periods. Some women have longer waiting periods. Certainly there's been more restriction on funding. There's been more efforts to generate fetal personhood statutes that would make abortion illegal in various ways. In fact, one state just passed the requirement that a woman has to inform the person she's pregnant by that she's pregnant, even if that person's her rapist, that she's having an abortion, and they have to get the consent. So there have been more laws that are more barriers that have been put into place. And I think that's been a reflection of the pledge that President Trump made to be an anti-abortion president and to appoint a Supreme Court justice. And he's followed through on his pledges, and that's emboldened people at the state and local level. So I think Roe has become more vulnerable than it's ever been. But in lieu of that, there's been more difficult access at the local level, even though road remains in place.
So what does this mean for you and in your practice when you were already going to places where women were traveling, you know, hundreds of miles perhaps to be able to get an abortion?
Well, I think what it's done is it's put more women in that position as clinics close, so because they can't comply with the regulations that have nothing to do with safety, women have to travel longer distances. But one of the things I think people fail to understand is that when a woman's determined not to continue a pregnancy that she doesn't want, she will jump through whatever hoops that are put in front of her. And even if abortion becomes illegal, women will still try and end pregnancies that they don't want or take other drastic measures.
To go back to the days before Roe.
Correct. What we know about abortion access. Right now, abortion rates in this country are at the lowest they've been since Roe became legal. And in fact, the abortion rate has fallen below the rate of what it was in 1973. That's because what's different now is we have better methods of long-acting contraception. So the unintended pregnancy rate is lower than it used to be because we have better contraception. So abortion rates are lower. But what we know is abortion rate, the abortion numbers don't differ much based on whether or not abortion is legal. What differs greatly is whether or not women are severely injured or die from unsafe abortion. So we're seeing low abortion rates, and despite that, people who are opposed to abortion have been able to create the narrative that abortion rates are sky high and that they're worsening, when in fact the abortion rates are going down.
So why do you think that the actual facts of what that level of abortion is and the fact that they've been slowly decreasing and then greatly decreasing as we've had better contraception, why is that story not told as well? And do you think that even in the face of those kinds of facts, that those who are predisposed to believing that abortion is murder will ever be able to come around?
The reasons, I think, are twofold. Number one, with the advent of this president, before there was no name to having the ability to totally ignore the truth. Now we create the notion of alternative facts. The anti-abortion movement has been very effective in framing abortion as harmful to women or as barbaric in terms of creating the notion that fetuses can feel pain. And so for people who, despite the facts that I just illuminated, the ones who want to insist that abortion is immoral is wrong. It's been a willful ignorance, if you will, and I don't say ignorance to disparage anyone, but there's not knowing and then there's not wanting to know. And I think for the people who are ideologically driven and who've decided that it is their prerogative to control the reproductive lives of women, they are able to persist in their notion that abortion is immoral and that it's unsafe. And so there's what I call a willful ignorance, and that's to the detriment and danger of women. So it's there's not knowing, there's not wanting to know. And so even though we have the evidence and the facts matter, people persist. And I think the reason that is also is because those of us who are scientists and those of us who believe the facts matter and that they speak for themselves, we fail to mount the moral argument for women to provide taking care of themselves and their health by being in control of their reproductive lives. So we will allow abortion to be stigmatized and shamed, and we've conceded the moral high ground. And so even when women know, and even when we know that abortion is in the best interest of women, the stigma and shame makes women really reticent to seek this very important care.
You make the point that it's often tough for scientists to make a moral argument, and yet we're seemingly witnessing a change to how scientists are willing to behave in the public sphere, coming out and talking about a great many things that in past perhaps they would have left to others and just stayed in their lab to do their work. Has that been something that you're also seeing when you talk to other scientists about what's happening with women?
Well, increasingly we're seeing people find their voice and their moral authority. But what scientists are realizing is that science and religion answers different types of questions. I think Dr. King said that best. He said science gives humankind knowledge, which is power. Religion gives humankind wisdom, which is control. The two are not enemies. Science deals mainly with facts. Religion deals mainly with values. And I think scientists are understanding that they can no longer stand aside and just say, okay, we will come up with the mechanisms of how things work, and those facts should speak for themselves. I think, as evidenced by the March for Science, where scientists took to the streets to say that science and facts matter, and they were no longer willing to stand on the sidelines and concede to people and policymakers that they could ignore science and facts. So I think scientists are now embracing the fact that their efforts as scientists don't absolve them of their responsibility to participate civically and participate in the political process that governs science.
Or to be able to participate religiously either. You have always maintained that you are a Christian and you're also someone who is willing to perform abortions, much to the consternation of those who also call themselves, or at least some of those who call themselves Christians. Have you been able to make any better bridge with anyone? Have you seen any of those in the religious community begin to look at it from your perspective? Is there a group of people who are like you too, and are they growing?
There have been people who are opposed to abortion because they thought that that was the only position they could hold as people of faith who found empowerment or at least have been engaged. I have had, although I don't have a large sample, but I have encountered people who have been willing to have honest dialogue and have been willing to honestly disagree. Which the Mahatma Gandhi says is the beginning of progress. So I think there are people who have been willing to be open-minded, but I think at the present there seems to be as many, if not more, people who's rather than engaging and understanding that there can be plurality and diversity and religious understanding around reproduction, it seems to be more, they've been more interested in asserting that I'm not authentically or legitimately Christian because I claim a faith identity and do abortions. So it's been a mixed bag, but I do think that more people are finding their voice and are rejecting the notion that there's a zero-sum game between being people of faith and being evidence-based and compassionate healthcare providers to provide abortion, or as well as people, women who have a faith identity who seek abortions because the majority of women, well over 60% of them, when they are asked about their faith identity, they have a religious understanding of some sort.
Dr. Parker, always good to talk to you. Thanks so much for the time today.
The pleasure is all mine. Thank you for the interview.
Former Hawaii resident Dr. Willie Parker traded in his private practice and his penthouse in Hawaii for the life of an itinerant abortion provider in Alabama, Mississippi, and Georgia. He's on his way back to Honolulu to speak about his memoir, Life's Work, A Moral Argument for Choice, on Thursday evening at the Church of the Crossroads. Details are on our Facebook page, The Conversation.
Hi, I'm Brian Guadagno from Raw Elements Certified Natural Sunscreen. Hear the conversation live or anytime you want on the HPR mobile app. Find it in Apple App Store or Google Play.
Many universities offering dance education often separate majors and departments by the type of dance, ballet, for example. At the Korean National University of the Arts, or K-Arts as it's known, dance divisions are different. The school's dance majors align with the student's ability in practice, creation, and theory. Munae Choi is the artistic director at the Korea National University of the Arts and one of the featured artists of the 2017 Asia-Pacific Dance Festival that starts today, and she's in our studio with us now. Welcome.
Aloha. How are you?
Aloha. Okay. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
When you look at how dance is taught in the United States, and very often it seems to be segmented by, is it, you know, ballet, is it modern dance, whatever it may be, that seems to be a different view than what happens at your university. So when you see that, how do you then look at how you want to teach dance as you now do?
Our university has a choreography department, which is very unique department because once students get into the class, they have to learn three different dance techniques, such as ballet, modern dance, and Korean dance. Also, they have to learn many different kinds of improvisation methods and also choreography skills. And also, they have to present their own show and also participate in the faculty concert and guest artist performance so they can develop their own choreography styles.
That's an interesting thing to think about, someone being in choreography, but being asked to understand many different disciplines of dance, but all with the idea of being a choreographer.
Not being a choreographer, but main focus is a choreographer. But, you know, also they can develop their own, they can develop a career as a dancer, or they can develop a career as a dance therapist, you know. But our main goal is develop a choreographer, but it's not the most, you can see they can develop many different ways.
How do you first begin to see what a student might be best suited to do, whether that person should maybe be a choreographer or someone who should be performing?
I can see some students are very interested in performing in different kinds of artists, and some other students very interested in develop their own choreography. So I can see two different possibilities for the student.
Which one wins?
Which one wins?
Which one is the one that begins to be the main focus for that student if they have to go into one of those, you know, three departments?
I'm sorry, I don't understand the question. I'm sorry, no, English is not my first language.
No,
so
you're,
sorry.
You're doing beautifully. But for a student that you may see has the ability to perform, but also has a deep interest in choreography.
Yes.
So which department would you put that person in?
Oh, because we have four different dance departments. One is ballet department, one is modern dance department, one is Korean dance department, and the last one is choreography department. So choreography department is separate. So students get into the choreography department, they have to learn three different dance techniques. At the same time, they have to learn many kinds of choreography methods and improvisation skills. So they cannot go which one go first, which one they have to choose when they got into the university. They want to go choreography department, or they want to go ballet department, or they want to go dance department.
So now you are here for the festival and to be able to share some of how you teach. When you are teaching the class that will have people here from the dance department at UH, what is it that you feel you can bring to them that they can't get someplace else?
So I like to teach my breath technique for the warming up. So when you exhale, your body can stretch. When you inhale, your body can contraction. So like you can feel how far your body can go stretch, how far you can go deeply making a contraction by using breath technique. Also, I like to teach modern dance technique, but also combining my own skills and push and pull technique. So my style is contemporary dance, but I used to be a Korean dance when I was young. So I like to combine Korean dance and contemporary dance so they can explore Korea contemporary dance, not Western style modern dance.
That's going to be a very interesting class. I wish you a great deal of satisfaction in both teaching it and enjoying everything else that's happening in the festival.
Oh, thank you.
Munhae Choi is the artistic director at the Korea National University of the Arts. She's here for the 2017 Asia Pacific Dance Festival. You can find out more about it on our Facebook page, The Conversation.
Aloha mai kako. This is Ku'uipo Kumukahi, Manager of Hawaiian Culture and Community Relations at the Hyatt Regency Waikiki, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
We're going to get back to the backyard quiz. Today we asked you for the name of a complex water delivery system on Molokai that makes farming possible. Built in the late 1960s, this engineering marvel is the primary source of water for the island's agriculture. It collects surface and groundwater from the rainy mountains of northern Molokai and delivers it to the drier but flatter region in the central area that's much better suited for farming. The system is entirely gravity-fed and incorporates a 5-mile tunnel, concrete flumes, and over 4 miles of pipe. Collected water eventually settles into a 1.4-billion-gallon reservoir. From there, it's distributed to 230 customers using an additional 22 miles of piping. By law, 2/3 of this water is reserved for use by Native Hawaiians on Hawaiian homestead lands, but farms of all types and sizes are currently served by the Molokai Irrigation System, or MIS. And nobody knew that answer today, so we'll just keep our tote bag for tomorrow. If you've got a backyard quiz for us, you can always send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. There are so many community activities every day around the islands. Morning Edition host and our colleague Derek Malama keeps track of some of the ones that might be a little under the radar, and he joins us now with some of those. You've got one. Good morning, Derek.
Good morning.
Or good afternoon, or good evening, whenever you may be listening to us. You know, people learning how to create designs using Hawaiian bamboo stamps has always intrigued me. I've collected, you know, all kinds of, you know, stamps for doing all kinds of other stuff. But how these are actually made and used out of the bamboo really is quite fascinating.
Right. And tomorrow on the Big Island, you can learn about, in Hawaiian, it's called Ohe Kapala. And they were originally used to decorate clothing with symbolic meaning. The stamps are now used to tell stories on a wide variety of modern materials. There is a workshop tomorrow. It's on the Kilauea Visitor Center Lanai, and it's happening at 10 a.m., and it's free.
That's always a good part, too, mm-hmm. when you get to learn something and not have to pay for it. Also on Hawaii Island, we were talking to the Sierra Club a little earlier today, but they're also going to be out in force for a monthly meeting, and hoping that others will join them.
That's right. And you were speaking earlier this hour with the club's chair, Heather Kimball, right? And about the North Kona water shortage. Tomorrow's meeting with Heather is in the Keaau Community Center, and you can talk story about the environmental issues that concern you besides the water shortage. There's a potluck at 5:30, and the meeting begins at 6 o'clock tomorrow in Keaau. And you can support Zero Waste by bringing your own plate and cup, if you can, for the potluck before the meeting.
We have some experience with doing that kind of thing,
oh,
too.
Yes, that's during our pledge drive.
A good opportunity to sit down and do some of that friend-to-friend talk about not just the water shortage, but other issues, too.
Right.
And what about on Thursday? Obviously, we're talking about the dance festival a moment ago, but you've got some more.
Right. The Asia-Pacific Dance Festival begins at UH Manoa. And it starts with an evening of performance and conversation with key figures in the hula community. Kumu hula Michael Pili Pang will host a talk story about Hapa Haole hula. And joining him in the discussion and showcasing hula of the time will be dancers Lemomi Maldonado and Kanoi Miller. If you have been to the Halekulani, you may have remembered Kanoi. Let's see. Oh, radio personality and creator of Territorial Airwaves, Harry B. Soria, will be there as well.
That's going to be a fun evening.
It's Thursday at 7:30.
Part of the festival, and that continues, I think, until the 7th of August. So
right,
lots
at
to
UH
see if
Manoa.
You like dance. Mm-hmm. A lot. And we've got lots of that on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. Thanks, Derek.
You're welcome.
And that's going to do it for us for today. Now, up tomorrow, there's a new charter school on Oahu. We'll find out why it's being called the Dream House. We'll also talk about why Marshallese adoptions are again on the rise. Those are just a few of the conversations coming up tomorrow. Meanwhile, you can comment about anything you hear on the program. There are lots of ways to be in touch. You can call our talkback line, 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Find us on Facebook or on Twitter. And also, if you missed any part of the conversation or any of the shows that you'd like to listen to on Hawaii Public Radio, you can find them on our app. Just search for HPR in the Apple Store or on Google Play. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Let's meet up tomorrow for more of the conversation.